Last week, a group of scientific advisors to the Environmental Protection Agency voted unanimously to approve a recommendation that a chemical used in the manufacture of Teflon and other nonstick and stain-resistant products should be considered a, quote, likely carcinogen. This language is important as it goes beyond the EPA's own previous determination that there was only, quote, suggestive evidence. Tim Kropp is a toxicologist with the Environmental Working Group. He joins us today from Washington, D.C. Tim, how are you?
Good. Thanks for having me.
Tim, can you start by, the chemical that we're talking about is called perfluorooctanoic acid. Am I saying that correctly?
Yes, you are. Some people call it PFOA or C8.
Okay. Can you explain briefly what that is and what it has to do with Teflon?
It's actually quite a complicated question, but I'll try to do it as simply as possible. The chemical is used to make the Teflon in pans, but it's not left over in the pan once the consumer gets it. But Teflon is a brand name. It's not a chemical, so they can use it for all kinds of things. Sometimes you'll see it on clothing that has a stain-resistant coating on it. This chemical also is a breakdown product of the chemicals that are used for that stain-resistant on clothing or on carpets or the oil-resistant paper packaging that you see. So the source to people, even though it's called the Teflon chemical, is more likely these other sources like food packaging than it is the pan.
Okay, and how long have scientists been studying the health effects of this chemical? Of this family of chemicals?
Well, industry scientists have been studying it for decades. In fact, DuPont recently had the largest ever administrative fine levied against them for withholding evidence about its toxicity from the EPA for over two decades. This has only been in sort of the public arena and available to independent scientists in the last 4 or 5 years when it was uncovered that DuPont and 3M knew all this information and didn't tell anyone. It really came to the fore because 3M got out of the business in 2000 because they were concerned about these chemicals. And at the same time, DuPont ramped up production to sort of fill the void that 3M left.
Mm-hmm. And I see in comments to the APA Science Advisory Board, industry scientist Robert Rickard writes, and I quote, "To have the industry review process not use all, quote, all relevant scientific information, or worse, to selectively use the information will clearly result in an incomplete and outdated review." Do you think this is a little specious given DuPont's own studies that have demonstrated toxicity?
Well, I think that sort of the panel's report speaks for itself. I mean, you have a large number of independent scientists from across the country determining that the evidence is sufficient to call it a likely human carcinogen, and that, you know, that there are all sorts of other effects that the EPA should consider important when doing their risk assessment. So I think that outcome really speaks for itself, because, I mean, I could talk more about, you know, why that's wrong, but the important point is that an independent group of scientists have determined that those are the appropriate terms.
And why is that difference important, this phrasing suggesting toxicity and likely carcinogen? What does that exactly mean?
The reason that is so important, that slight difference, is that if it's called a likely human carcinogen, then the EPA has to go back and actually include that in their risk assessment and figure out what the risk is to the general population. These chemicals are in over 96% of Americans' blood. And when you have that widespread exposure, it's important for the EPA to figure out what the risks are to the average American person. And they didn't have to do that before, and they didn't do it before. But with this higher classification, they have to go figure that out.
96% of human blood, how was that assessed?
The 3M company actually did the test where they found it in Red Cross blood banks. That actually coincided with the time that they got out of the business. They were doing studies on their workers, and they wanted to try to find a control population. So they were looking at blood, and they went to Red Cross blood banks to try to get control blood. And they looked at that and found out that it was contaminated, and kept on sort of going out in wider and wider circles with Red Cross blood, and turned out that over 96% of the samples that they had were contaminated. And that's at the point when they realized not only do we have a chemical that's harmful, it has somehow ended up in every American's blood, and that's when they decided to get out of the business.
That's a lot of blood.
Yes, it is. I mean, it's also been found in rain, in snow. It's been found in the middle of the Pacific and the Atlantic Ocean, and you can imagine how much of a chemical you would have to dump in an ocean to get it to show up in the middle of it. So the contamination is quite widespread.
How is it winding up in an ocean?
Well, there's a couple different theories about that, but the prevailing one is that the chemicals that are the precursor to the chemical in our blood, the PFOA, are volatile. They can actually come off of the products, like the carpet and the clothing and the food packaging, and either break down to PFOA inside you, or they can go up into the air, travel for miles, and then break down. And once they break down, they'll sort of precipitate out of the air and end up in, you know, the polar bears or the Pacific Ocean.
And not too far downstream from actual processing plants, we've noted the well-documented cases of toxicity in populations around the production plant in Ohio.
Yes, worker studies have shown increases in leukemia, increases in prostate cancer. One of the most consistently found effect is an increase in cholesterol, which is also related to findings of increased risk of stroke. Now, the general population really can't be studied well, and this, again, speaks to how 3M did their study, is that there isn't a really good control population, because people from, you know, the four continents that have been tested all have it in them, and as I said, 96% of Americans. And so you really don't have an adequate control group to figure out how the general population might be being affected.
Let me quote from Robert Rickard again. He's a DuPont scientist. He states, quote, epidemiology studies published to date indicate no known health effects in workers at exposure levels approximately 1,000 times the levels in the general population. Is he lying?
Well, first of all, the epidemiological studies done by DuPont and by 3M have shown the effects that I just talked about, like leukemia and prostate cancer, and the Science Advisory Board to the EPA has noted them. But I think the best way for listeners to understand what DuPont means when they say that is to think about or go find a press release by DuPont last year when they ended one of their studies, and the title was "No Human Health Effects Found from PFOA." And then even in the first paragraph of the study, they noted that they found increased cholesterol in their workers, but they're saying that that's not a human health effect. So you get down to the nitty-gritty of defining, well, what is a health effect? And I think that, you know, most people understand that increases in the bad cholesterol, not even the good cholesterol, is not a good thing, and would consider that a health effect.
Is it your area of expertise to speculate on why it would have an effect on cholesterol levels?
Yes, there's a couple of ideas on why. We're not exactly sure why, but PFOA looks like a fatty acid, which is used for many things in the body, except for all the hydrogens are replaced with fluorine. It's a bond that cannot be broken down. And anytime when you have something that sort of mimics something in the body with one significant sort of little change, you have the potential for toxicity. And the fact that fatty acids are involved in metabolism, involved in cholesterol and things like that, makes it not surprising that you have effects on those same areas in animal studies and in some of the epidemiological studies that have been done.
Okay, and what is the EPA's recommendation following this information? What is the industry's expected response?
Well, EPA has not responded yet to this report. They have just gotten it, although it's very rare for EPA to disregard advice from an independent panel. So it is likely that, you know, that they'll go ahead and have to do a risk assessment. Now, you know, them saying that this is a likely human carcinogen, it doesn't mean that that the chemical gets banned or anything happens. All that has to happen is that a risk assessment is done, and I think that that's pretty reasonable. There's no reason not to want more information.
Mm-hmm. And what effect could that have on the industry? I mean, do they What, do you have a sense of what it would take to reduce these levels in things, items that are manufactured?
Well, one significant thing that's happened in the past couple of weeks, which I think may have been affected by these decisions, is that DuPont, as well as a couple other companies, have committed voluntarily to start phasing these chemicals out. And they have agreed to phase them out 95% by 2015. So I think that it's not a direct sort of outcome of this panel meeting, but I think it was affected by it. Now, that sort of voluntary agreement, it is voluntary, and there's a lot more that needs to be figured out, because there's a lot of sort of little loopholes in the agreements that that need to be stopped, but it's really a good start. And I think that these panel's recommendations really underscore how important it is to reduce those levels in consumer products.
I'm speaking with Tim Kropp. He's a toxicologist with the Environmental Working Group. Now, there were dissenters on this panel, correct?
Yes. On some of the questions, there were up to 4 out of the 16 members dissenting. There were either 3 or 4 on certain questions. As you will have on almost any scientific questions, you're going to have some people that that don't agree or dissent, but the large majority of the people on the panel agreed with the final outcome.
I noted that the Environmental Working Group has in the past noted a perhaps inappropriate relationship between members of the Scientific Advisory Board and former members of the industry, representatives of the industry. Can you talk about that?
Well, some of the members on the panel have ties to organizations that would not be seen as credible organizations. One of these is the American Council for on Science and Health, which is funded by industry and has, you know, said all kinds of crazy things like mercury in fish is not a problem, and, you know, PCBs are not a problem, and things like that, that are way outside the scientific mainstream.
Oh, come on, you're just being alarmist.
And it is concerning to us here that people can end up on an esteemed panel to take a look at a very serious issue who have ideas that are well outside, you know, accepted facts. Everyone has different opinions, but when you start going outside what's really known, then you have significant problems. But I think that they were obviously overruled on this panel, and, you know, that in the face of all this evidence, no matter, you know, what your personal feelings are, most of them came to the conclusion of, you know, this is a significant problem. We need to do something about it.
Tim Kropp, what can the average consumer do, if anything, to avoid ingesting these chemicals?
Well, there's a couple simple things that people can do. One of the things that they can do is not use microwave popcorn bags, because we know that that's a significant source. It's actually really easy to use a brown paper bag and 2 staples. Don't worry, it's not a problem in a normal microwave. And just pour a quarter cup of popcorn in there, and it'll pop just like you bought it from, you know, whatever the microwave popcorn company is. That's one thing people can do. The other thing is, to next time you go out and get clothing, is to not opt for that stain resistance. But in general, because these chemicals are used in so many things, people can't always know what it's used in and what it's not used in. Like, is the bakery tissue actually wax paper, or is it coated with these perfluorochemicals? Many times it's very hard to tell. And you shouldn't have to have a PhD in toxicology and chemistry to go pick out a pair of pants. So that's why it's really important here that the federal government step in and do something. But I think it's been shown they've been very concerned about it for many years and haven't been able to do anything. And finally, when they do something, it's voluntary, which really speaks to the weakness of our rules that control toxic substances in the U.S.
So if we're walking through a bakery, for instance, or we're walking through our day and we're eating things, what sorts of things would we look for?
Well, it can be all kinds of different packaged foods. As I mentioned before, microwave popcorn is one. Bakery tissue is another. Basically, almost any paper product you have where you don't want grease to go from one side to the other, whether it be like cardboard that's holding cookies or anything like that. potentially has these chemicals coated on it. However, there are alternatives. They're just not as common. So it's impossible for the average person or even an astute scientist to actually look at a piece of paper and say, yes, that chemical is a perfluorochemical.
And DuPont's own scientists, correct me if I'm wrong, they came across alternative and less toxic wrapping methods, have they not?
Yes. I mean, many of the alternatives are well known, but they've clearly said that they were just not as profitable, so they, you know, they didn't use them. And I think that if you look at how things have happened, EPA's largest administrative fine ever was about $16 million, and DuPont makes about $300 million a year on these chemicals. And so hiding that sort of information for two decades, they can just build it into the cost of doing business. So, you know, they have alternatives, but it just, it's not worth it for them from a cost basis. And just as, you know, sort of how a company behaves, they're only beholden to the bottom line, which is really why we need those regulations, because you can't count on companies doing the right thing.
Tim Kropp, can you tell us a little bit more about your organization, the Environmental Working Group, and you're not funded by the manufacturers of stainless steel cookware, are you?
No. Environmental Working Group is a research and watchdog organization. We do things on agriculture as well as public health, mainly through just disseminating information. There's so much data that the government has and so many studies that the government has that most people can't read, most people can't understand. And so what our group does is try to take that information and just explain to the public what's in there to understand, you know, what's your government doing, or, you know, what are different industries doing in ways that, you know, everyone can understand whether it's right or wrong, and you know, people can make those decisions for themselves.
And what is your website address?
It's www.ewg.org.
Okay, thank you so much, Tim Kropp, for joining us today on The Politics of Food.
Thanks again for having me.
Okay, great. Thank you.